You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 25th, 2016. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Steeder. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Luke Mayville of Columbia University will join us to talk about Bernie Sanders. What are his politics really, and how does change really happen? Also, the CIA is subcontracting to Saudi Arabia and Syria. That continues in the history of using Saudi subcontracting in the Middle East and in South Asia. Does that really strategically sound? Also, Michael Bloomberg, he also hears the delusional call to run for president. Is it really legitimate, or is it just a threat to Bernie Sanders voters? We'll talk about that, and obviously I will do the Bloomberg impression for a long time on the fun half of today's program. China making moves in Iran as sanctions are relaxed on that country. Ted Cruz was even more awkward and sociopathic as a college student, which is kind of mind-blowing. After you watch this footage we have of him, I think everybody will be clear. From the most conservative to the most socialist, that this guy really can't be president for just basic social reasons. Donald Trump had a lot more to say, and what the hell, we'll play it. He is the Republican frontrunner, despite the intervention of Jeb Bush's mother. That didn't appear to make any difference, shockingly. And as Donald Trump himself pointed out, you know, Jeb, can't call your mom to deal with ISIS or China. China. Jeb responded with, "My mom loves me, and you're a mean man." And George W. responded with, "Guess while you were reading books and I was doing blow, somebody was presidential timber." Yeah, folks. And Marco Rubio continued his quest of mediocrity and opportunism. And Chris Christie continued to bloviate. They're not making any dents. It's a two-person race, and it's a two-person race in the Democratic field. It was blizzard weekend here in New York. I haven't had a weekend like that in ages. I stayed out really late Friday night, had a great time. I still did not think it was actually going to happen. I just never believed these weather fear stories. I'm kind of like, I'm almost like one of those Oregon militiamen when it comes to the Weather Channel. I'm just like, I don't believe it, man. It's like government and stuff. I never buy it. I was getting back to Brooklyn really early in the morning, and it was coming down. I was like, wow, maybe this is real. And on Saturday night, I had plans. I was supposed to actually be a surprise birthday party for a really good friend of mine, totally bailed on it, and basically just spent the weekend sleeping and watching documentaries. I haven't had a weekend like that in a long time. It was great. And I watched this good documentary on Richard Holbrook on his career and his legacy. It was definitely worth watching. How was the blizzard for everyone else? Matt, how was your conflict with God over the weekend?
Mine was great. I watched the first two episodes of Mr. Robot, made some more puppy chow, which I keep doing.
You notice the difference there that you watch Mr. Robot and I watched Holbrook, a documentary?
Okay, well, I did.
That's how you get on the ball, son.
Guess what? I watched some of the Iran-Contra hearings, too, so.
You could have a Trump there. I watched the Iran-Contra hearings, too, so I think I did a pretty fantastic job this weekend. I did a great job. It was great. That was good. By the way, I'm going to do a lot more communist Trump. I enjoyed that character on Friday. Ho Chi Minh, great guy. Kelly, what's up with you? How was your blizzard?
It was great. I usually sleep a lot and watch documentaries on the weekend, so it was a lot like yours. But I discovered that my dog is a little more aggressive than average.
And really?
Yeah. It turns out that is the case, and so I'm going to have to really ramp up my knowledge and maybe get a trainer to help the puppy.
And they know that, like, based off of how old's the puppy?
She's 13 weeks now.
And they can already determine that this is a problem beyond just being a puppy?
I don't know who you think they is, because she hasn't gotten all of her vaccinations yet. So
you're determining it.
Yeah,
got it.
Based on a book that I've been reading, and I've tried not to do too much stuff on the internet, but
is it called Scientology for dogs?
No.
I like it. Kelly's just like, yeah, I'm just bunkered up watching docs, and my unvaccinated dog is totally bad.
No, she's almost self-diagnosis. She's almost done with her. There are rounds of vaccination, so she's almost done.
Oh, I see.
And it definitely part of the problem is anyone who has had a puppy that's had to do this, she's stuck and she has too much energy and she needs exercise. And so I can't do that yet, but I'm going to figure this thing out and I'm going to set her on a path to success. So that's what I figured out this weekend. That was
good stuff. Sound like Jeb Bush there. I like that.
Well, that's
I'm
not
figure
good.
It out. No, I'm sure Jeb Bush can handle.
I'm
going to
do
training.
It. I mean, she's very high energy. I would say so high energy that she's blowing her own mind on a second by second basis. So I'm going to try to get on her level and bring it down.
It sounds like she could be useful to the Jeb campaign.
She really could. Anyone who wanted to say anything bad about Jeb would. I mean, we should just take her to Trump.
Just she could maul Trump. all right, everybody, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Luke Mayville on The Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Luke Mayville. He is a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University at their Center for American Studies and author of the forthcoming book, John Adams and the Fear of American Oligarchy. Also a good friend of mine. Luke, how are you?
I'm great. It's really great to be with you, Michael.
It's really, really good to have you on. And I've been thinking a lot about this sort of debate that has been bubbling up about the Democratic primary in some respects has become a really interesting learning moment in a variety of ways. First of all, because Bernie Sanders has identified himself as a Democratic socialist, and we'll start there in terms of sort of teasing out what political identities actually mean when people sort of define themselves in different ways. And that's a lot of work that you do from a scholarly and research perspective. And then more recently, this election has also sort of kickstarted a conversation about how change actually happens. So let's start, though, with a piece that you wrote several weeks ago in Commonweal called Is Bernie Sanders a New Deal Liberal? And what you were doing was you were sort of looking at this conversation about where Bernie Sanders' politics actually fit. He identifies as a democratic socialist in the sort of European Scandinavian mode. Other people have actually sort of disputed that to a degree and basically just said, look, this guy is just a classic liberal. He's an FDR liberal. Before we tease out those distinctions, what is the sort of basic difference, I guess, between calling somebody an FDR-style liberal or a more kind of Scandinavian-style socialist? Or is there very little distinction there?
Well, I think the distinction is important, although it's often overlooked, the extent to which FDR, what we call FDR liberals, did have something that looks a lot like what we think of as social democracy as part of their program. But one important feature, I think, of liberalism in the American tradition going back to FDR, kind of modern liberalism, is that there really was an emphasis on liberty. And that's something that sometimes gets obscured in our modern context because, you know, today when we think of freedom and liberty, we're in a lot of ways we're much more often to default on, you know, right-wing kinds of thinking, as you're familiar with on your show with a lot of the libertarian callers who will call in, you know, defending liberty. It's a word that has been appropriated in many ways. But when I've been struck by the extent to which when you go back and, you know, read FDR's speeches and read some of the liberal texts of the time, you actually do find a lot of emphasis on, you know, economic equality, working conditions, and improving working conditions. But to a large extent, those arguments were grounded in, you know, an argument about what are the conditions under which Americans would really be free. And I think the social democratic tradition, which again isn't completely alien to the United States,
right.
But the kind of social democratic tradition that we associate with Scandinavia, I think the emphasis there is much more on thinking of justice and injustice in terms of fairness, a basic social fairness. And another thing that I think that Bernie especially is reviving is a sense of the public and a sense of the value of, you know, actually having something that we can call the public interest rather than thinking of the public as a kind of aggregation of private interests. And this has really come out, for example, in the recent Democratic debate where, you know, Bernie is defending Medicare for all. And a big part of his argument is that, look, you know, yes, we're going to have some more taxation. But in exchange for that, what we're going to see is a major shift of costs from the private sphere to the public sphere. And that's something that we should be willing to do because in so many ways, public goods are valuable.
And also, practically speaking, we would save, you know, as an individual on an individual consumer level, we would save a lot if we move to a single payer system. So if your taxes go up, say $50 a month, but you're spending a couple $100 less on, you know, private expenditures, you're obviously in a net positive. One of these things, and I want to get back to teasing out this distinction a little bit more, but one example that I always remember was in college, I remember taking a lot of studies on kind of European Union, European studies. And one of these courses, the professor broke down. He had also, He taught at Bates, and he also taught at a business school in Denmark. And he explained to us one time how much in taxes he spent in Denmark, and it was kind of mind-blowing. But then we sort of did a line-by-line breakdown of, okay, in exchange for this taxes, I get, you know, outstanding health insurance coverage. I get all of these sort of tremendous public goods from child care to, you know, public parks and recreation. And then when you compared it to the line-by-line breakdown of here's how much I spend on insurance in the United States, even though I'm covered, and here's how much I spend on this service and that service. And by the time you would run it down, the expenditure was really very similar. And in fact, in some respects, the layers of bureaucracy you were dealing with were more convoluted in America, because instead of having one sort of provider and a direct relationship with it, you had many more layers of red tape, even if it was private red tape that you needed to deal with. And that's another kind of important cognitive shift, that bureaucracy and red tape versus efficiency and delivery is a question that transcends the private and public sector. And I think that that's a very important kind of intellectual shift that Americans have to make. But let's get back. Go ahead.
I was just going to jump in and say, I think one and very important argument that Bernie Sanders is trying to introduce to our debates is, you know, we're used to thinking of redistribution in terms of, you know, distributing from the, you know, the non-rich, from the rich to the non-rich, or from the rich to the poor. I mean, we don't do it nearly enough, but that's the terms that we're used to thinking of it in. One argument that Bernie's making is that you can also have redistribution from the private to the public.
Right.
And that's a very important concept that I think is central to social democracy. And it's a powerful argument insofar as the public, as you're describing, that insofar as the public can do things more efficiently than the private programs can. So I think that's an important element of his kind of social democratic view as well.
Yeah, and let's get back just, and then we'll sort of pivot to a larger conversation. But it's really in this distinction that you draw out where you say, and I'll just quote from your piece, you quote FDR saying basically, and this is an FDR quote, "Life was no longer free, liberty no longer real, men can no longer follow the pursuit of their happiness." And this is his description of the effects of poverty and mass economic inequality. And you see this line of argument going through Obamacare when President Obama says, you know, if you're attached to a certain healthcare plan, or you know you'll lose insurance if you go out and start your own business, or you go out and you start a job that resonates with you more, that blocks your liberty, it blocks your pursuit of happiness, and it also blocks the possibility of you being entrepreneurial and innovating new products in the market. And that has sort of been the frame, as you say, of this sort of New Deal liberalism, whereas, and it is notable that Bernie has kind of pivoted in this presidential election to making much more of that type of argument. But historically, where you kind of are sort of arguing that Bernie Sanders really is much more in a distinctly kind of democratic socialist tradition, both European and here in terms of Eugene Debs and in terms of that type of argument, which is actually much more prevalent in the United States than people realize. I mean, this is a line of politics that had a lot of strength in the early part of the 20th century. You still see some, you know, polls sort of indicating support for democratic socialists, socialism amongst Democratic primary voters, but that Bernie Sanders was really talking about, and clearly still the sort of passion of his argument is the injustice and the unfairness of it versus the opportunity costs of it. And those are two very different frames, even if the policy aims are very similar.
Yeah, I mean, again, as you mentioned, Bernie has pivoted somewhat. So I actually have in front of me some of his speech on his democratic socialist vision that he delivered at Georgetown a few months ago.
Right.
And in that, he directly appealed back to the New Deal legacy. And, you know, he says things like, people are not truly free when they're unable to feed their family, you know, when they're unable to retire with dignity, they're not truly free, or when they're unemployed or underpaid, when they're exhausted by working long hours, when they have no health care. All of these things are constraints on freedom, constraints right. on the way FDR described it, is constraints on the pursuit of happiness. But what struck me was that there seems to be something of a mismatch between this kind of New Deal language that Bernie has used when he's really pressed on the meaning of democratic socialism, or maybe when he's pitching it to a larger and perhaps a more skeptical audience.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a mismatch between those moments and his larger rhetoric and his stump speeches, wherein it's much more common for him to describe these same kinds of injustices just in terms of, you know, grotesque unfairness.
Right.
So he's much more likely to just, you know, point out the extent to which our money in politics, you know, is turning us into a kind of oligarchy, or, you know, the way that the sheer level of inequality that we've reached is just morally indefensible. One really interesting point of comparison, I think, is the way that, you know, a liberal or a democratic socialist could talk about hunger and, you know, like widespread hunger in the country. And for example, FDR in some of his speeches, and famously he described hunger as something like want, and that could constrain your opportunities. And, you know, one of his four freedoms in the famous Four Freedoms speech was, you know, freedom from want. And, you know, there's this implicit idea that, you know, living in a state of want actually constrains your life possibilities. And that seems very, I think that seems very intuitive to a lot of people when you make that argument, that especially, you know, if you think about the poverty of children as constraining their life possibilities, the the hunger of children as constraining their life possibilities in a really tangible way.
Right.
Bernie Sanders, I think, is more likely to immediately reach for just the crude kind of unfairness that
the sort of just shocking immorality of a society with so many resources allowing that level of human suffering.
For example, to just, you know, draw pictures of, you know, for the public of, you know, children going hungry while we're giving tax breaks to the rich.
Right.
And that kind of disparity, and I think it's important. I don't mean this to be too deep of a critique, because I think that just that grotesque kind of unfairness is just as important as the freedom side of it. But it does seem to me, and this is specifically you know, thinking about the character of the American political tradition, it seems that freedom is a very powerful idea, and that it's a powerful progressive idea to think of freedom in terms of opportunity and life possibilities.
So is before sorry to jump in, I just, before we kind of move off of this, I hear what you're saying. Then to me it seems like it introduces another debate, which again, I think it's important to always emphasize that if Bernie Sanders was not in this race, we would not be having these conversations, because we would have the sort of, you know, we would basically have a kind of technocratic centrist argument versus a crazy argument, which has typically been what things sort of boil down to between Democrats and Republicans in recent elections. But I guess the other way of sort of framing it is you're talking about, you know, the negative freedom, which is kind of what freedom has sort of become a stand-in for. But I think in some ways I don't want to give too much credit, to be honest with you, when it comes to modern iterations of Republican and conservative politics, which I think are much more kind of attitudinal and about stance and about a sort of, yeah, really an attitude, less sort of a kind of actual philosophy of governance. But that said, there's the notion of freedom from you know, the king, freedom from the central government, freedom from the demand to be compelled to do anything. And that's where the sort of language of freedom that we usually hear in today's politics comes from, versus positive freedoms, which are obviously the freedom to fulfill your potential, or more, you know, prosaically, the freedom to live a good and decent life, even if you're not a sort of exceptional performer in the economy, which is also what it seems like some of these debates kind of break down to. It seems like, you know, Bernie Sanders, because he's speaking in a moral language, he's kind of having to carry both arguments in some respects. He's sort of having to reintroduce an argument about positive freedom, but also at the same time articulate the just raw moral grotesqueness of so much kind of wasted life, essentially, because of such a massive misallocation of resources. And, you know, he has to do those at the same time.
Yeah, I would only add, I think that's a good way of putting it, I would only add that when we talk about, you know, positive and negative freedoms, you know, freedom to do things rather than, you know, as contrasted with freedom from, you know, invasions in our personal lives, I would add that there's a progressive vision of negative freedom as well, which I think was a major part of, you know, the New Deal legacy and a lot of that, the politics of that era, which is, you know, the idea that emphasizes that we're not just subject to, you know, threats to freedom that would come from government, or that would come from concentrations of public power or bureaucracy. We're also subject to, you know, concentrations of economic power.
Right.
And also, you know, and something that really came out of the Great Depression was that we're subject to all kinds of arbitrary interference with our life that comes from, you know, mismanagement of the economy.
Right.
So, you know, financial crashes that were avoidable, disrupt our lives in all kinds of ways. And those things, you know, insofar as those things could be managed more efficiently, then, you know, it makes a lot of sense to say that we suffer from a threat to freedom insofar as they're not managed. So that's another element of, I think, the freedom appeal that's available to, you know, Bernie, and that he's tapped into to some extent, I think.
Yeah, and it also harkens back, I think, to what we were kind of getting at earlier in the Denmark example, which is really redefining, you know, similarly with the debate about bureaucracy. People sort of frame, you know, bureaucracy is the product of the public sector. It's not. It's the product of a certain type of bigness and a certain type of complexity that in some cases is really entirely unnecessary. And if you've mm-hmm. dealt with a credit card company or an insurance company, the level of bureaucracy you have to deal with would put any kind of government service provider to shame. And that's a sort of separate track debate about size and scale and how you're sort of treated as a consumer versus public versus public and private. In order for all of this to be relevant in some respects, we need to kind of get into the conversation as we sort of move towards wrapping this up, though, about theories of change. And, you know, clearly, if you look at the polls and you look at what's happening, Bernie Sanders is doing very, very well. He's opened up a significant lead in New Hampshire. He's edging Hillary Clinton in Iowa. I think, you know, frankly, as someone who is both, you know, quite enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders' message, you know, getting a wide audience, and I think he's fundamentally correct in many of the things he's saying, obviously. I'm also concerned, as someone who does think it's important, regardless, that Democrats sort of hold on to the White House, that this is actually really revealing some structural weaknesses that Hillary Clinton has as a candidate. And partially how that is being revealed is in this sort of meltdown and backlash against Bernie Sanders from the sort of, for lack of a better word, kind of establishment sort of liberal press. And the sort of more high-minded version of this critique is that Bernie Sanders' theory of change doesn't work. And it seems like people like Paul Krugman and Jonathan Chait have come out with a sort of twofold argument with regards to this. First of all, they're saying things like single payer is impractical at this point. I have to say, you know, Paul Krugman has written very effectively and very persuasively about why a single payer is the best policy choice moving forward in the past. So some of these sort of policy pivots when it comes to Bernie Sanders actually proposing it, I frankly find a little bit suspect. But the bigger argument, maybe in some respects the more persuasive argument, is that Bernie Sanders' theory of change, theory of kind of popular mobilization, is not going to work. And it's not going to work from, you know, getting elected and beating the Republicans, and it's not going to work from the perspective of running a sort of end zone sort of strategy around the Washington establishment. And I want to get your thoughts on this, but first we need to spell out these differences more. And Jedediah Purdy had an interesting response in Huffington Post where he said basically, you know, people like Krugman and Chait could be right about Bernie Sanders and maybe his theory of change is too optimistic, but they're wrong about what that theory of change is. So Bernie, you know, so basically Krugman, this is Purdy quoting Krugman. Krugman writes, "On the left, there's always been a contingent of idealistic voters eager to believe that a sufficiently high-minded leader can conjure up the better angels of American nature and persuade the broader public to support radical overhaul of our institutions." Purdy responds, "Krugman's mistake is very basic. He's wrong about the Sanders campaign's theory of change. It isn't that a single high-minded leader can draw out our best selves and translate that into a more humane, egalitarian lawmaking. It is that a campaign for a more equal and secure economy and stronger democracy can build power in networks of activists and alliances across constituencies. The movement that the campaign helps create can develop and give voice to a program that the same people will keep working for in and out of election cycles. In other words, this is a campaign about ideas and programs that happen to have a person named Bernie at its head." Now, we'll get into the substance of, you know, whether or not that's overly optimistic, but it does seem kind of stunning that all of these sort of critiques of Sanders seem to miss out on that very, very basic point. This is not a Barack Obama campaign. This is not a guy. I mean, he does have a certain type of charisma, but he does not have Barack Obama, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton charisma by any stretch of the imagination. And this is about an agenda that can activate a constituency. Now, I want your thoughts on both of those arguments, but it does seem to me that Purdy's correct that we need to actually at least be talking about what Sanders is actually talking about before we critique it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that Krugman and Chait and others are right to criticize the transformational leader theory of change that they, you know, attribute to a lot of Obama's early supporters, that they attribute to, say, the McGovern campaign, that, you know, if you get a pure enough, high-minded enough leader at the helm of your movement, then you can, on the strength of that alone, bring about a kind of transformational change in the country. It's also true, though, as you pointed out, that doesn't seem to be the theory of change that Sanders believes in, and it certainly doesn't seem, it also doesn't seem to be a theory of change that, you know, his, a lot of his supporters even believe in. And, you know, as you just laid it out, and I think especially well articulated by Jedediah Purdy in the article, the theory of change that Sanders has repeatedly articulated is that you can, you know, build a vast network of political activists and organizations, you know, at the local and state levels, that can move, as you said, move an agenda that can, you know, embody a new, more democratic socialist kind of ideology, and that can achieve change in that more grassroots kind of way. One point that I've wanted to make, and something that's really struck me, is that there is a question here, completely apart from, you know, these critiques from Krugman and Chait and others, that I don't think are necessarily on the mark. But apart from those critiques, there's a question of what kind of grassroots power can presidential campaigns actually build. And there it seems that Sanders might have something of a problem, because it's not clear to me from the history of presidential campaigns and the presidency that you can actually build the kind of grassroots power through a presidential campaign that would be capable of moving policy. Now, I want to be careful here because I don't want to dismiss the potential for building grassroots power in campaigns, but it seems to me when I look back at different cases, what campaigns like the Sanders campaign can achieve is something like a mass-based grassroots electoral power, a kind of power that can enable you, maybe the right way to think of it is not to move an agenda, but to build an ideological coalition that can win elections, especially. So, and not just, you know, presidential elections, not just future presidential elections, but also elections up and down the ticket.
And that's
a very important kind of power in its own right. But it's just not, so to give one case, that Jedediah Purdy actually emphasizes in his ideas about how the Sanders campaign could actually succeed in building power. He calls back to the New Deal and FDR's base of power. And he talks about, you know, the way that FDR was able to push through all kinds of ambitious reforms on the base of organized labor.
Right.
And other kinds of locally organized power. But there seems to me that there's a big mismatch here because when I look at a lot of the New Deal coalition, the kind of power that served as its basis wasn't mobilized through campaigns. Mm. It was typically mobilized somewhat independently. So in the modern context, you know, it would be something much more like the Fight for 15, rather than the Sanders campaign that would do the most to actually push policy once Sanders becomes president. So that's my intuition about it, is that there's something of a important distinction to be made between, you know, grassroots electoral power, the kind of power that can win elections, and the kind of grassroots power that could actually, you know, push through an agenda once Sanders is in office.
But is there really necessarily a contradiction with that? Because it would seem to me that if Bernie Sanders is elected president, then you would have, in a way that's absolutely unparalleled since, in fact, FDR, although, you know, it's such a different context in so many ways, obviously, but certainly in modern American politics, you would go from, you know, essentially the left in many ways having to sort of play defense, even with Democratic presidents, to a president who would say, look, my agenda is, you know, a pretty aggressive and bold agenda, at least with regards to economic inequality issues, so that the sort of blurring of the lines between the campaign apparatus and the grassroots apparatus seems a little bit more permeable. And again, because it also is really very much not about, you know, like Obama was able to do this, and it's actually kind of funny that people like Krugman use Obama's example because it certainly worked to become elected president. And I think that what people didn't quite recognize about Obama was that really, you know, the actual policy agenda, if you were listening to it and paying attention to it, was not, it really was never all that liberal. I supported Obama, and I always knew I was well to the left of Obama, and I supported Obama for other reasons. It was really about, as a sort of, as a leader, as a thinker, as a kind of presence on the national stage, we're going to make a shift. That was kind of the promise of President Obama. with Bernie Sanders, it's the promise of we're actually going to start, you know, dealing with the real things we need to deal with here that have been left dormant for far too long. So it seems like it's a different promise electorally. And I want to actually get, you know, I want to get your thoughts on that. And then I want to pivot to another historical example that you've given, because people, it seems like, you know, the other comparison with Bernie Sanders is McGovern and that sort of memory of, you know, high-minded liberal guy died in a, you know, basically got destroyed in like this mass blowout election. But there was another kind of high-minded political figure who got destroyed in a mass blowout election, and that was Barry Goldwater. And the contrasting political legacies of those two is that everybody after, you know, McGovern, including people who got their careers started working for McGovern, like the Clintons, ran away from that legacy in many respects. McGovern got destroyed, and then it laid the groundwork for the far-right takeover of the Republican Party, which is has gone on and, in fact, even just accentuated and amplified itself so much to the point where even some people around, you know, Barry Goldwater's family would say, hey, Barry Goldwater would, you know, probably be, he might even, like, endorse Obama or something at this point, you know, because of how totally extreme the party has become. But those legacies are radically different. And I guess if we were going to circle back to the notion that Bernie Sanders is part of a larger activation of grassroots activism and people saying, look, we need to actually deal with these issues. It's not enough to sort of paint around the edges anymore. Is there a possibility of, you know, even in a worst case scenario, that type of legacy versus a McGovern scenario?
Yeah, it's interesting when we're having this debate over theories of change, which again, that's another debate that is really, you know, being brought about by the Sanders campaign, which is good. I think, but when we're having this debate, you can really break things down in an interesting way with these case studies from the past. So, but, you know, for Krugman and Tate, you know, the relevant comparison here would seem to be McGovern, and to some extent, you know, the more successful version of McGovern and Obama, right? But but the relevant comparison for Sanders, especially because they don't think Sanders will win, is McGovern as a kind of noble, high-minded leader who seemed to embody the aspirations to transform the country, and they can look on that and look at how that failed, and then on the other side of the debate, there's a tendency, among those who are defending Sanders from this critique, there's a tendency to go straight back to FDR and to think about the kind of grassroots mobilization of the Sanders campaign in terms of this New Deal coalition of, you know, locally organized power. But it does strike me that in many ways the Goldwater comparison is the right one. Nothing to do with ideology, obviously, but what the Goldwater campaign succeeded in doing wasn't necessarily putting together a coalition that could push an agenda in government. And if you think about it, it's an interesting counterfactual to think about. What if Goldwater had won? He would have won on the base of a new kind of activism, a newly organized ideological coalition of a kind that, you know, completely differed from the conservative politics of the time. He likely would have faced pretty steep Democratic opposition in Congress that probably would have obstructed his agenda in fundamental ways, in a very similar way that a Sanders presidency would likely face in terms of Republican obstructionism and, you know, in 2017.
Well, everybody's going to face that. I mean, I think that that's important,
right,
just as a note,
right,
for, you know,
that's
Hillary, right, Clinton pushing a, you know, moderate technocratic agenda is going to face the same thing. But, right,
absolutely,
regardless, yeah.
Yeah. So, but if you just think about the kind of what a Goldwater victory would look like, it wouldn't have necessarily been that he could have actually pushed his agenda while in office with the base that he had organized. But what's absolutely true looking back is that so much of the network that Goldwater was able to organize and that the Goldwater campaign brought into existence, you know, it really turned out to be the basic building blocks for the ascendancy of modern conservatism, and especially for the ascendancy of Ronald Reagan, which was a presidency that many thought was completely impossible.
So basically,
all the way up until the time it happened.
So basically, Bernie Sanders is laying the groundwork for when we run together in about 15, 20 years on
exactly.
a socialist
that's
ticket.
I
get it.
Yeah,
I see the plan, Luke. I love it. I'm with it.
But there is a basic distinction here. I think between the kind of power that you can build that really pays off in terms of future electoral organizing. And part of it, I mean, might come down to, you know, what the actual nature of the activism is.
Right.
And that, you know, there is something of a distinction when we look out at American politics, maybe when we look at politics more generally, you know, in modern democracies, that there's a kind of division of labor between, and here I'm thinking about, there's a really interesting book called Ruling Passions by a political scientist named Andrew Sobel, and he has this argument that there's a basic division of labor between the kind of politics that organizes communities and that really builds that kind of power that can shape policy.
Right.
There's a difference between that kind of politics and the kind of and electoral politics and the kinds of politics you engage in when you want to win offices. And
right.
And it's not that one or the other is more important, but to some extent they are distinct. Although I do agree with you that the line can get blurry.
And I think the other aspect of this that's also important to mention, we're about to wrap up, but I want your thoughts on this briefly, is that in conjunction with whatever analogy we're using, I actually really do think that whoever the Democratic nominee is very well positioned to defeat the Republican candidates, particularly Trump or Cruz, who I really think it will be one of those two that gets the nomination. I'm in no way banking on any type of McGovern or Goldwater scenario just from an electoral point of view. I don't think it's there. I think the electorate looks radically different. I mean, this is an electorate where, you know, Jimmy Carter would have beat Ronald Reagan if we were just voting purely on the same, you know, just proportionally, just the nature of how the demographics of America have changed. But I think the other aspect of it is that looking to the future, you know, while the, you know, the bigotry of Trump and all the flashiness of all of that gets most of the attention, the coalition that Bernie Sanders is speaking to, as well as shifting attitudes about everything from social safety net to the reality of the, you know, climate crisis to how America should be in the world to, you know, people having families later in life, people more likely to live in urban environments than suburban environments. The type of politics he's articulating is not some, you know, it's not a throwback. It's very much the future. So when you kind of fuse that demographically, it seems to me that the only thing that can kind of structurally stand in the way of that is what he's talking about when he talks about essentially the, you know, the mass undue influence of the ultra wealthy and corporate special interests on our politics. Because if it just follows its natural course, it is going to be a much more Bernie Sanders style America than, you know, many people can contemplate.
I think I at least for the most part agree. I think that the basic structural issues that the Sanders campaign is speaking directly to are the fundamental structural issues. That said, there is a challenge involved in introducing the public, you know, beyond the Democratic primary electorate, introducing the public to a new kind of ideology. Mm-hmm. But I think of a lot of the challenges to, persuade voters that the same structural problems you know, of inequality and economic insecurity that people really feel and they know are out there,
yep.
That those structural problems line up with something like this ideology, that and that there's a big gulf between the ways we've been thinking up until now and the actual conditions on the ground.
Right.
That said, I don't think it's inevitable, just because I think it involves a lot of persuasion.
Yeah, I think that's maybe where you and I differ. I don't think it's inevitable, less so because, I mean, I think persuasion is a part of it, but I think the real reason it would not be inevitable is just because of the raw power and raw undue influence of people who have raw power and undue influence. I mean, I think even regardless of what ideological spin we put on it, we would have much tougher regulations on Wall Street. We would have far more accessible college. We would have much better healthcare if not for the, you know, the raw reality of the power of whether it's Wall Street or the Kochs or whoever else, that really distorts the progression of the system more than anything else.
I think that, yes, I think that's true. And I also think that part of the raw power of undue influence is the ability to fund arguments.
Right.
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 So, if you have an endless bank of money to draw from to try to persuade people that no fundamental change is necessary in order to respond to, you know, inequality and economic insecurity, then, you know, that can really have a lasting impact. And
right.
I mean, it's sad to admit it, but I think it's right that you can actually, that the power of money is partly the ability to actually pay for arguments and to actually win over hearts and minds with your money. And,
right.
and that's the kind of uphill battle that I think we face moving forward. One of the concerns that I have is that, you know, insofar as those of us who support the Sanders campaign, insofar as we place a lot of hopes in the kind of power that can be built through the campaign, I think it's important that we at least keep, you know, scrutinizing what we actually mean when we talk about the power that we can build, so that we, you know, place our hopes in the right places and not the wrong places, because, you know, hoping for the wrong kind of thing can lead to a disenchantment that would really be a repeat of what a lot of people have experienced in the last 8 years.
Whether or not
it was justified. But,
right. You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, it seemed like a Mick Jagger moment. Luke Mayville is a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University at the Center for American Studies. His forthcoming book is John Adams and the Fear of American Oligarchy. Do you have a publishing date on that yet, Luke?
Probably end of the summer.
Great. And can you tell us who's publishing that?
It's Princeton University Press.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. And you know, as friends, I've seen the early iterations of it. It's going to be a great book. I really, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks so much, Michael. See you soon.
Bye. All right, everybody. That was another edition of texting one of my paisans to get a guest. But it was good. We are going to go to the fun half of the show. What's up with you? You make such bizarre faces. So become a member of the Majority Report today. Do it for less than a cup of coffee. Go to majorityreport.fm/become a member. It's what makes this show possible. Every time people say they become a member, whether they're I am about it, whether they send an email, they're thrilled that they did it. And again, literally, that's how every aspect of this operation exists. Write us a review on iTunes. That helps. If you are a member, please also subscribe on iTunes to the Majority Report. That pushes us up the rankings and gets us in front of more eyeballs. Go to Majority. Is it majorityreport.fm/kickback? I always forget. It's majorityreport. Do you know that, Matt?
I think it's I don't know off the top of my head. I think majority.fm/kickback.
Will you look that up? So we're going to get that for you in a second. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We got a lot of sound for you in the fun half of the program. We've got Ted Cruz sounding, even by his standards, really bizarre and disturbing. We have Donald Trump, I guess, just sounding like himself, or as you might know it, bizarre and disturbing. I'm going to talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia subcontracting in Syria. That's not distracting at all. And our history of using Saudi as a subcontractor. And, of course, we will get to Michael Bloomberg's big, fantastic presidential adventure, all in the fun half. What was that information?
Majority.fm kickback. /kickback.
Majority.fm/kickback. You can use our jet.com link. Jet.com is awesome. It's a socially responsible version of Amazon. And if you just need to use Amazon because, you know, either for whatever reason you're still sticking with Amazon, you can use our Amazon link there as well. Either way helps us a lot. See you on the fun half.